Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Lavanya Vemsani. She is a professor in the Department of History at Shawnee State University. We get to speak about a really fascinating new piece of scholarship called Feminine Journeys of the Mahabharata, Hindu Women in History, Text, and Practice. It is a brand new 2021 publication by Palgrave Macmillan. Lavanya, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Raj, for having me today. I am really looking forward to speaking with you about the book.
Great. I'm glad that you are. Most of my guests dread having to speak to me about their books. No, I'm teasing. You're excited about this publication, and so you should be. Can you tell us a bit about your journey towards the feminine journeys of the Mahabharata? How did this enterprise begin for you?
It's really hard to pinpoint. As you know, for anyone growing up in India, it's hard to know when you first heard Mahabharata stories. And it's even hard.
You have to state the famous quote from Ramanujan that many of our lay audience may not know, that no one hears the Mahabharata for the first time, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So I don't know when I first heard Damayanti, when I first heard Shakuntala, when I first heard Kunti. So I heard them many, many times, and they so much so that they're part of my life. You know, when I read them, it almost seems like I know them. It's that much. But more recently, though, I taught a course at McMaster University in the Department of Comparative Literatures. It's called 2MO3 Asian Literatures. So for that, I actually examined journeys of women from number of texts, classical literatures from Asia. So this actually gave me a chance to examine the women's stories, women's journeys closely, and organize what I was thinking. So I would say the real beginnings, I don't know. But the research beginnings, of course, I'll point to my course at McMaster University. So that was the beginning, but it took many years, though. So their journeys were difficult. And my journey to write this book also took a long time. The thoughts to come together and form a book took a long time, too.
Yes, well, much like the Mahabharata, sometimes gestations are much longer than others, right? There's so many points of entry for this conversation. Why don't you tell us, in terms of method or data, you're primarily looking at narrative from the critical edition of the Mahabharata, correct? Or what else are you looking at?
Yes, I am primarily looking at the critical edition of the Mahabharata, and I also used the Vulgate for some of the chapters, because there was more data. You know, for example, Draupadi, some data was cut in the critical edition, but Vulgate had all that. So critical edition a lot, and I also used the Vulgate edition a lot. Even though I checked the original Sanskrit text, I used the translations as quotations in my book. So I used one of the early translations, you know, the Rai translations and, you know, the translations most commonly available for quotations in the textbook.
And so tell us about the layout of the book. Which figures do you look at?
There are 11 feminine heroics as well as feminine divine that I study in this book. I begin with Satyavati as the matriarch, and they then go on with others, Kunti, Draupadi, Savitri, Damayanti, Amba, Urvashi, and probably one of the least studied, I would say, is Madhavi that I attempted in this book. Madhavi was sometimes mentioned, but only her first half of life is noted by anybody. The second half is not noted. So I tried to take up her story also along with the others. So there are 11 stories, 11 journeys of women, feminine heroics, feminine leaders, in addition to the conclusion and introduction.
So I have a tendency of asking consciously naive questions. Hopefully my audience knows that they're consciously naive, or maybe you think I'm not very informed at all. But why is this book important? You know, what's new exciting about this book? Where does it fit into your subfield of Mahabharata studies?
It fits in the Mahabharata studies by focusing exclusively on one aspect, the feminine. Of course, there are studies focusing on feminine. You know, there is Draupadi, there is Kunti, there are, you know, studies on feminine. Of course, Ganga. But a comprehensive examination that undertakes a study of more than 10 women of different walks of life is not there. That's one thing. And secondly, in the last 50 years, the media, academia, the modernity, the focus was more on male perspectives, male perceptions. Even though the female stories were analyzed, they're analyzed from a male perspective. For example, the feminine divine as well as feminine leaders are seen as, from the utilitarian perspective, as spouse goddesses, spouses are mother. So a useful part of a man's life. Of course, that's nothing wrong, you know, it was common in those days. So that only brought out a partial understanding of the women's journeys, because it gave them these categorizations, calling them spouse goddesses or derogatory names, you know, tooth goddesses or breast goddesses. You know? So if the names are derogatory, of course, the studies are going to be also derogatory. So that was there, the categorizations and early studies, you know, being partial. In addition, they attempted to read only certain feminine, not all of them. And they also attempted to read only part of the life of the feminine rather than a holistic understanding. And it also did not use the Indian philosophical and cultural understanding. For example, personhood, according to Indian philosophy, is a blend of masculine and feminine. The feminine expression is seen more as nurturing, happy, and in sync with nature. Masculine expression, of course, seen differently. But the feminine expression and masculine expression is found differently in different feminine heroics that we examined in this book. So it actually gives us an opportunity to see the stories and the journeys of women in a long and comparative perspective. And it also allows us to see in an Indian sense of the expression of the feminine, rather than seeing them just as females, just as sexualized, utilitarian subjects of study, like the spouses or mothers.
You make a number of points there in terms of how your approach or your methodology is different than previous scholarship. Just to flesh this out a bit, so when you're looking at a particular female figure, the Kunti or whomever, you are looking at the life story, are you not? You're looking at the arc of that character as a whole, versus let's understand Gandhari through the blindfold related to her husband. Let's understand Draupadi through this terrible scene in the assembly. I'm not trying to put words into your mouth. I'm hoping to bring them out of your mouth because I think you're a bit modest in terms of what's original about what you're doing. So right. Correct me if I'm wrong, because right. Obviously I'm not very well read in Hindu studies. neither narrative, neither the Mahabharata, but you were looking at the narrative, the arc of the character in the Mahabharata as a whole, correct? Mm-hmm.
So,
yes, go on.
So I take the life of heroic and then study her life from her birth and to the end of her life, when she takes, most of the time, many of these women lived a fulfilling life and they took sannyasa. So I study, beginning with the birth, up until the sannyasa, how it went. So it's an exploration of femininity, how it is expressed in each of their stories, each of their journey. Not in just one part, but total journey of their life. So, for example, the journeys show different aspects of femininity. Even though the generalized idea of femininity is feminine is playful, simple, happy, as well as forgiving. However, we see the different aspects in each one of the stories. The pure and simple feminine nature is seen in the stories of Shakuntala and Damayanti, which is sustained even after numerous travels. They go through the forest, they go through a number of difficulties, but still remain to be simple feminine, unlike others. For example, in the story of Draupadi, we see the fiery feminine nature. And the feminine nature that went beyond the feminine to embrace the masculine is seen in the case of Amba, right? She forgets her femininity in her anger and then embraces masculinity to take her revenge. So so that's also an expression we see here. And the feminine that embraces and forgives everyone and everything, as we see in the case of Ganga and Kunti. Both of them are the mothers, the quintessential mothers of the Mahabharata. And the feminine heroics were depicted as human, but at the same time, they also defied the physical limitations. For example, Savitri and Madhavi. Savitri, a simple feminine. However, she makes her own choices and she's even able to follow Yama to his world. And finally, the divine feminine, Subhadra. She is multifaceted goddess. She has three different forms and, you know, they all fuse together in her. And of course, we have Satyavati. She is completely human, surrounded by all these divine feminine and divine, semi-divine heroics. However, she is the strongest survivor, and she is the representative of the feminine, sheer perseverance and strong woman of all. Even though she is simple, she comes from humble beginnings and remains simple, but Satyavati remains, you know, one of the very interesting characters of the Mahabharata. So each one of them show five stages in life. And each stage shows their development and then how they became what they are and how they supported their partners. Except for the divine. Divine feminine, of course, Subhadra and Ganga doesn't show typical stages like all these others, but all of them show different aspects and expressions of the feminine. And that's what is the goal of this study. You know, that's the central focus of this study. How this feminine is expressed through their life, through the stories of their life.
You mentioned at the outset in passing that something that disambiguates, that separates this work methodologically pertains to gender and gender studies. Could you say a bit more about that?
Gender, of course, I told you, in Indian philosophy, Indian understanding, the spirit, the personhood, as well as the body are different expressions of life. The personhood is a combination of masculine and feminine, and the expression of which might differ. And the body, of course, is an accumulation of food. So it's called Annamaya Kosha, you know, the five sacs that form the person. But the inner spirit is formed by the masculine and feminine aspects. They are in everybody, every person. The personhood, of course, is within everybody. So the feminine expression, as part of the gender studies, the feminine expression as part of the female leader's journeys forms part of this study. That is one aspect. But the second part is how the feminine, of course, might also change the expression. Might also become different. You know, the feminine becomes submissive as Amba looks to achieve her goal. She becomes more masculine in her goal. And she is, of course, pushed into a corner because her opponent is, you know, Bhishma. Bhishma refuses to engage with women in any way. No war, no marriage, no... doesn't he doesn't even want to speak, you know, when Draupadi was disrobed. People ask him to respond, but he doesn't respond. He doesn't want to involve himself in any way with women. Of course, he brought you know, the Amba from her Swayamvara, but other than that, he doesn't want to directly involve himself in any way with women. So Amba, of course, she has her feminine expression. She loved somebody. She wanted to marry him. She wanted to have a good life, but it was all ruined because of what Bhishma inadvertently did. There is no way to go back on it. So she chooses to fight it out. So in her search to fight it out, she has to forget her femininity and embrace masculinity, which was very difficult. She undertakes many asceticisms in this life, takes help from grandfather, takes from Parashurama to fight Bhishma, doesn't work, and then takes asceticism and gets curse from Ganga. A lot of difficulties. I'm so sad for Amba, you know. She was yanked out of her Swayamvara and then there is no recourse to her. And I sympathize with her, you know, and giving up her femininity and to embrace masculinity so that she can fight Bhishma. Of course, even in the end, you know, she takes another birth and then with the blessings of Shiva, she was able to, you know, be born to a family that supported her, that actually raised her as a man, taught her all the arts and crafts of warfare. So she was able to live as a masculine person, even though she is born as a woman. So this is where it shows us clearly, you know, that the feminine is not expressed in case of Shikhandin. The masculine is expressed right from his second birth, from her second birth. It's masculine. Anyway, she changes her gender in the later part of her life after her marriage. You know, her wife complains, so then she goes and exchanges her gender with a yaksha. Anyway, when he comes back, of course, the family had already raised him as a man and accepted his masculinity. So for them, it's not a problem. But others, probably it took a little bit of time to accept him. And Bhishma, of course, refuses to engage with him on the battlefield. But everyone else accepted him very openly. Krishna actually drove him into the battlefield, which is, you know, considered as one of the honors. He drove the greatest warrior, Arjuna, and then the other person that was driven in the chariot was Shikhandin. Bhishma, of course, falls because he doesn't accept him or his masculinity. But this story is a clear expression of the Indian convention of the personhood, of the feminine and masculine, and the expression of masculine as it changes in her.
What would you say is the key takeaway from having, or takeaways, I should say, from having looked at all of these journeys?
The key takeaway... I hope people would understand this different understanding of gender in Indian philosophy and India, different understanding of personhood and different understanding of body-mind complex. And another aspect is that the feminine leaders and feminine divine were not fully understood, I think. They were only partially understood. Most of these journeys, for example, they would not be complete and they would not be these journeys if the women were not there. For example, Nala would not have come home if Damayanti was not there. The Mahabharata would not have turned this way if Draupadi was not there. Draupadi and her family, her brothers, Shikhandin and Drishtadyumna were an important part of Mahabharata war. And similarly, of course, if Kunti was not there, you know, it would have been a different story. It would not have happened. Of course, Shakuntala, you can say this about every one of them. Savitri, if Savitri was not there, Satyavan would not have come home. So the stories are very important. The female characters are central. And the feminine leaders had the freedom of choice to think as well as express themselves in the way that was suited to them, that was good for them. Which means, you know, the swatantrata. They have the swatantrata to be themselves without having any limitations. And they had the freedom. You know, it was thought that the ashramas were developed with men in mind. But if you read these stories, women were part of these ashrama stages. They were taking, you know, sannyasa. They were also following these ethics. They were also getting educated, and you would see many women as part of the ashramas, you know, the Gautama's ashrama and Shakuntala's story and all that. So a number of takeaways on women's life, how they lived and how they have independence of choice. And also the concept of gender and femininity and masculinity as it is understood in Indian philosophy. So I think these are the main takeaways.
Do you see these stories from the Mahabharata as evidencing an historical reality, or do you see them as evidencing an imaginaire do you take these stories as indicative of what women behind the world of the text were actually doing, perhaps? Or do you take them primarily as how they may have been idealized or imagined?
This is a question we all struggle with, right? all Hindu scholars, all Hindu scholars that are involved with the textual studies, you know, how far we can take it as, you know, fact. There are, of course, discussions. I don't launch into the discussion on textual aspects and how far we can take it as a fact, because, you know, I'm focusing on understanding the life journeys of the women and general perceptions. And I'm trying to do this in, you know, 200 or 250 pages. So I don't launch into too many discussions. But others have done it. Others have said, Mahabharata preserves strong female roles, female leaders, female journeys. So others have thought, even though women were not mentioned as composers, probably they were close by. So the composition stayed true to what they were, even though they may have been edited a little bit. But women's roles remained strong enough, did not undergo too much editorial exorcism. So, you know, so remained a little bit true to what it was. Because probably women were part of or either stayed close to the compositions. So this is what most of the other scholars have said. I haven't indulged in textual, you know, history or criticism.
So I imagine that you quite enjoyed each and every one of these feminine figures, but tell us, which one or two chapters did you find most compelling or most illuminating? Or let's foreground a little bit of the nuts and bolts of your work. Pick a chapter we can dive into.
I love all of them, but I like Damayanti a lot.
And why do you like Damayanti so much? What is it about Damayanti that you like? Damayanti, what is it that you show about Damayanti?
Damayanti is, you know, of course, written as a character, you know, like a story in the Mahabharata, but she still forms part of culture in India. And Damayanti is the story that I learned from my mother and remember a lot. I come from, you know, central India, which is on the borders of Vidarbha. So she is, you know, Vaidarbhi, the daughter of Vidarbha. So her story is very commonly heard in these regions. So, but her story, of course, is recollected in many stories. many other genre, you know. And I recently heard it in the folk genre also. Very interesting story. So my point is, her story is not just a story. It has become part of life in many parts of India. To remain still a part of folk culture, still a part of folk genre, and still be recollected as a story, and still be recollected as a woman of this place, you know, probably happened many generations ago. But she has the most historical provenance. And I like her because she is the innocent, the naive, and quiet woman. You know, she's not like Draupadi. She's not going to say, you know, oh, I'm going to come get you. You know, she doesn't say that. She's quiet. At the same time, she does what is needed. You know, she doesn't want to leave Nala, but she tells him, you know, I'm going to support you no matter what. He leaves, but, you know, she keeps her word. She finds him. She brings him back. She brings him back to senses. All this she does with her presence of mind and without being, you know, without showing it as, you know, kind of like a heroic effort. Like, she is the simple, naive woman, even in the last chapter of her life. She does everything, but she does it in a simple way.
It's a different kind of strength, isn't it? It's very powerful.
Yeah, silent strength, you know. So she amazes everybody.
So you prefer silent strength over the sass of Draupadi. Okay, good to know.
Kunti is similar too, you know. Kunti doesn't express, but you know what she wants. And her children and everybody around her know what she wants.
So what is it about this silent strength that you think is more favorable or desirable? Do you believe that it's presented that way in the text, or is it that you personally are more drawn to it?
Maybe I'm personally drawn to it because I think the text presented the expression of femininity in the number of ways that it presented. Just to show that, you know, the expression of femininity, the expression of personhood in any aspect is right. Nothing is, you know, prohibited. It's a wrong question in history to ask why or, you know, why they did this or why it is like this. You know, we can only understand how this happened and how it is represented. So the way it is represented, the text shows different expressions of femininity. Of course, we might be drawn to one or the other expression of personhood as it is seen, but it doesn't mean that another expression of femininity is not right. Right? I am equally enchanted by all these different expressions of femininity. Draupadi, of course, you know, fascinating. who can forget her? You know, if they hear about her story once, you cannot forget her. She is such brave at the same time, you know, an enchanting woman. So
she's certainly a compelling character. Yeah. Now, if someone were to say to you, let's just say, would you agree with the notion that female characters are marginalized in the Mahabharata? What would you say to that?
There is some editing probably might have happened in some sections. But I don't think it completely erased their character. So they still remain strong. And I think in this aspect, most of the other scholars would also agree with me that Mahabharata preserves strong female characters, even though they are subjected to some kind of changes, but minimal changes. They don't really affect their character a lot. You might see, you know, small small editorial, you know, insertions here and there. But I don't think they fully affected their character. And do you think they seem weak to you? I don't think Amba looks weak, or Draupadi looks weak, or Damayanti looks weak.
Well, I think weakness is one characteristic. The question was pertaining to marginalization. So certainly, in my view, there's no shortage of strong female characters in the Sanskrit epics, without question. Sita is eloquent. The geisha, she schools Rama at every turn. Draupadi, all the more with her sass and her insistence. But the question is, you know, we have this notion on behalf of lay people reading the texts, even scholars and students, of women being marginalized in these overtly patriarchal works. And it seems to me that you may have a different or more nuanced position than most, which is why I bring to you this question of, well, you know, are women marginalized in the Mahabharata, would you say? Women or female characters?
Probably this somewhat might have been done, but still it hadn't erased their character. Their strengths and their character remain strong. For example, you know, Savitri, Damayanti, Kunti. Of course, there are some sentences here and there, but doesn't really change their character a lot.
Could you say a bit about the role of the forest in Forest Exile?
Yeah, all of them. You know, when I first read these stories closely, you know, when you hear them, you don't really notice, you know, you're just hearing the whole story from someone. So, you know. But when I closely read them, every one of them, there is forest, there is exile, and forest repeatedly in some stories. And some stories like Urvashi, you know, she appears in the forest and the nature, the wind, you know, the symbolism is more obvious in celestial moment. So, you know, it's always there. So one aspect, I think, is the consideration that femininity is in sync with nature. Right, the expression of nature is as spontaneous as you know. Sometimes it might be, you know, scary, but you know, most of the time it's pleasant. So as pleasant and as scary as the nature can be. So and also the cyclical nature of the nature is also considered to be in sync with the feminine nature. You know, that's the reason Indian texts, classical texts, philosophy often identify feminine with the nature, with the Prakriti. And her journeys, I don't see any exception. All of the women go through this forest exile and also go through the life begin. Sometimes begins in the forest or sometimes ends in the forest. So I really think it symbolizes the journey of the women and their close affinity with nature and expressed in almost all the stories. So for male characters, any masculine characters that are narrated in Mahabharata and other classical texts, it's always narrated as the written, as the success, as the real part of the life. But for women, for any of the women that we studied in this book, the journey, the exile is the central part of life. How they go through this journey and then how they successfully face this exile and come out of it, that's the crux of their life. So journey is the success, not the return.
And it's almost always a forest journey, isn't it?
Forest journey, almost always.
Perhaps we can recite the book Feminine Forest Journeys of the Mahabharata.
And Madhavi, of course, you know, stops her life halfway to go into the forest.
No, it's such an important theme. It really, to me, this idea of royals in the forest, this is, you know, this play between poverty and liberty. You know, this is this tension, this right. tension of Hinduism, really, it seems to me. Fascinating. Who might be interested in this book?
I think all the academics that study these subjects closely and the Mahabharata closely.
All 12 of us. Okay, beyond the 12 of us. Okay, actually, it's Mahabharata. Maybe 22. Beyond the 22.
Breathe and sleep on the Mahabharata. So for us, it's fascinating and interesting. And in addition to the, you know, to our coterie, you know, there is also a general interest among many, you know, even though they haven't been to the graduate school and all that, there is an interest in the Mahabharata, there is an interest in the stories, and there is an interest to learn about gender, the true nature of gender and how it is expressed in classical texts and what it means from classical Indian understanding. So this might be also an interesting read for the general reader. I actually wrote it in a simple, I stayed away from you know, classical literary textualisms of words we use, yeah. I stayed away from all terminology and theories and, you know, so I wrote it in a real simple way so that, you know, it's interesting and useful for us, but at the same time, it's also useful for anyone interested in reading it.
You know, to me, that's the absolute sweet spot. Good scholarship written accessibly. And I find that without really consciously trying, that's something I come up against. Whether teaching continuing studies, whether teaching online courses, whether, you know, you name it. That's the sweet spot. You know, there's the audience that you were talking about who might be interested in this, obviously specialists clearly, and obviously probably most interested in South Asia in some sense, or who study it. But there is a huge audience of lifelong learners, of continuing studies students. Some of them study at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies with us. There's a new course on the Mahabharata coming out. There's an existing one on the epics. But they often have questions pertaining to the role of women. It's great to say, oh, there's this really accessible piece of scholarship. Check this out. This might help to broaden your view or to assuage your concern or whatever is coming up, or, you know, to deepen your knowledge on the subject. So it's really interesting to me that without trying, I taught continuing studies at the University of Toronto for 10 years, and now I do so at the OCHS, but everything from even this podcast itself fell into my lap. It started off as a favor and then became, you know, a hobby. Now it's a lifestyle, but it's right at that intersection between, you know, the ivory tower and the interested public, right? And I think it's really important.
Mm-hmm. We're all thankful you're doing it, Raj. You know, you're trying to bridge this gap between academia and the general readers, the general interested public who want to know these subjects and study more.
Well, I'm glad that you're thankful. I speak into a black box in my home office in Midtown Toronto, in between, you know, real work, although obviously this is work and I love it. It's a labor of love. And so you never quite know what's on the other end of the black box, but I'm glad that scholars are valuing it. That's great. Yeah. Is there anything else about the book that you wanted to touch on before we close today?
I think we touched on all aspects of the book, on the journeys and everything.
Fantastic. Thank you for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me here. And thank you.
Great. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Lavanya Vemsani on her brand new 2021 Palgrave Macmillan publication, feminine journeys of the Mahabharata, Hindu women in history, text, and practice. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating feminine figures in ancient Indian epics. Take care.